This is Audible.
Harper One and Harper Audio present Backstage Pass by Paul Stanley. Read by Sean Pratt. Business and Success. Chapter 1. Let the past be the past. Last spring, I returned to West 211th Street in Upper Manhattan, to the one-bedroom apartment where I grew up. It hadn't been a happy home, to put it mildly. I hadn't been in that building in 60 years. I'd driven by it once or twice, and I hadn't had a good feeling when I did. This time I had a specific reason to go there, along with my wife Erin, and my oldest son Evan, my three younger children, Colin, age 12, Sarah, age 10, and Emily, age 7, were with me, and I wanted them to see the place where I'd started my life. I hoped it would help them understand the difference between their lives and mine. Years ago, I had visited the area in Queens where my family moved when we left Upper Manhattan. Queens is where I lived when I went to high school, started playing music, and met a bass player named Gene Simmons, and eventually started Kiss. But after that visit, I fell into a few weeks of feeling miserable. It sort of confirmed what I had always thought. These places from my past held only negative associations for me. Still, I thought it was important to give it another try. I hoped this visit to 211th Street would offer a beautiful chance to give concrete reality to the stories I've told my kids over the years, to make my childhood memories into something tangible for them. So we went back, or I should say, I went back, since they'd never been there. I was born with a crumpled mass of cartilage instead of a right ear, a facial difference known as microtia. From the time I can remember, people stared at me, both kids and adults. People seemed to detach a deformity from the person. Instead of being treated like a human being, I was treated like an object of curiosity in some cases, I guess, but most often an object of disgust. When I started to attend the elementary school right next door to our apartment, PS 98, I didn't have any friends, but I was always the center of attention. And that sort of attention felt just horrific to a 5-year-old. I wanted to disappear or hide, but there was no place to go. It was one thing when somebody stared at me. That was bad enough. But when someone yelled out at me, that drew other people's eyes to me. Everyone would look at me, scrutinize me. I felt violated and threatened to my core. These were the worst moments. Like the kid who would point and yell, "Stanley, the one-eared monster!" All I could think was, "You're hurting me." On top of that, I never had a shoulder to cry on. My parents insisted on not talking about it. Kids need parents. Kids need protection. When my parents didn't empathize with me and didn't want to hear about my problems, I felt cut off from everybody. For most of my life, West 211th Street had represented just one thing for me. Pain. But now, as I drove up toward the apartment, I wondered whether it would be different. We arrived and walked through the entry arch to the 5-story walk-up and stepped into a paved space surrounded by the building. To call it a courtyard would make it sound too nice. Memories started to rush back. Crossing the yard, I suddenly remembered jumping on another kid's back and biting him. This kid had taunted me and spat in my face. The courtyard triggered the memory because I'd been there one day with my mom and explained to her that this kid had been bullying me and hinted that I might want or need her help dealing with the situation, and she had told me, a kindergartner, to fight my own battles. "Don't come crying to me," she said, which led to my attacking the kid. Entering the apartment, my initial reaction was surprise at how small the place was. Obviously, when we remember something in one scale, based on our size and stature as a child, and we go back, it's startling. The building was also a bit run down, but it was the size that really surprised me. As small as I remember it, this was so much smaller. And 4 of us had lived in it, my parents, my sister, and me. My parents had slept in the living room on a fold-out sofa, and if my sister or I got up earlier than them and wanted to go to the kitchen, we had to crawl under the bed. My heart was racing. I was a bit lightheaded. Back outside, we saw the school next door and the schoolyard where I'd been called Stanley, the one-eared monster. I've always told my kids to remember that their dad was teased and ridiculed. I've always told them that it hurt me and that they should remember, when dealing with other people, how I had been a target. That means a lot to them, and I see its impact in their eyes. Colin is aware of others' vulnerabilities, as is Sarah. Even Emily is keenly aware of the feelings of others. If it happened to their dad, it could happen to anybody. And it does, though during my childhood it never occurred to me that I might not be the only one to be bullied and to suffer. Children tend not to think in terms of how they fit into the wider world. I never thought about anyone else being taunted and bullied because my world was just me. And even if somebody else was being subjected to similar treatment, it didn't matter. I was still hurting. I wouldn't have been consoled knowing that somebody else was also getting beaten up. My children all know about my being stared at and pointed at, about my having trouble in school and not being able to hear, all kinds of adversity. It's the best way for them to really understand that sort of thing, to attach a face to it, my face, a face that, as a member of their family, probably means the most to them. But now, standing there in that apartment at schoolyard more than 60 years later, all of it felt like another lifetime. The memories were still there, but my connection to the place no longer had negative overtones. I could tell that, unlike earlier visits to places in my past, this one wasn't going to leave a mark. It wasn't going to cause pain or bitterness. That has everything to do with who I have become. And by that, I don't mean a globe-trotting rock star with a fancy house and a fancy car. I achieved that fairly early in my life and have realized it didn't help smooth over the emotional scars. At one time, I thought a Playboy playmate and a bank book full of cash was the answer. But it wasn't. I'd wanted so desperately to rub my fame in the faces of cruel classmates at reunions, but it didn't help me feel better. I'd wanted so badly to be desired by the sort of women who had always ignored me, but I found I still couldn't establish meaningful relationships. I had wanted so badly to surround myself with the trappings of success, but I found that stuff was still just stuff, no matter the price tag. On the one hand, I had accomplished everything I had ever wanted and more. But on the other, I still languished emotionally, never entirely comfortable with myself, never entirely happy. The beauty of success is that it has given me the potential to realize a quest to be the best me. But who I've become is different from who I thought I would become. And the reason why this visit to my childhood apartment was different from previous glimpses into my past was that when your life is in order, the chaos that you may have been through recedes and becomes irrelevant. I was once much more connected to those times and my struggles in that place. Yet now I was back there with none of that baggage. I felt some of the same emotions I felt when talking to my dad in recent years about the changes in our relationship. That place, 211th Street, may have been where I started, but it wasn't where I ended up, literally and figuratively. In some strange way, the place now seemed oddly beautiful, because of my sense of perspective, because I could see how far I had come. And again, I don't mean materially. I could now appreciate my past for the same reason I could finally write my story and face the music, and for the same reason my relationships with people like my father have continued to evolve since that book came out. We keep secrets when we haven't come to terms with the past. We are in turmoil when we haven't come to terms with our feelings. But once we are comfortable, we are freed by letting go. Going back to 211th Street was a terrific opportunity. a moment of clarity. When our lives correlate with being in a good place, I realized, then we're ready to unveil difficult things, because they're not the same burden they once were. We may have been unwilling victims in the past, but we can choose whether to allow that past to make us victims in the present and future. I often hear people express the idea that living well is the best revenge. But I don't know. If we're living well, we shouldn't need revenge. If we still feel that need, then maybe we're not living so well after all. Living well at this stage in my life means not needing revenge, not even wanting revenge. But then again, who really knows what it means to live well, at least in advance? For most of my life, I sure didn't. It was something I had to learn, the hard way, and over a long period of time. The thing is, life doesn't come with an instruction manual, so over the years, I've created my own. I spent a lifetime adding hard-earned principles to this instruction manual. And in following it, I've achieved not only traditional success, but also the peace of mind that allows me to see things in a different light. Up to now, that manual existed only in my head, but I decided to turn it into a reality in order to share it, to unveil it as a result of feeling unburdened by my past. Chapter 2. Be tough on yourself, but always be your own biggest fan. Growing up the way I did, I reached a point where I realized that patterning myself on the most obvious role models, my parents, was a dead end and would only lead to my downfall in one way or another. So I had to go back to square one and learn. I had to learn to walk again in a philosophical sense because I hadn't learned how to do it in a healthy way the first time around. That was my struggle. I don't say that for sympathy. I say that because we all have challenges. In my case, in addition to normal kid stuff, I faced the cruelty that comes with a physical difference and the ignorance back then about certain disabilities. Because I was deaf in one ear, I had trouble hearing in school. But instead of getting special help, I was simply dismissed as a bad student and sent to remedial classes. And through it all, my family failed to provide any sense of support. Well, to be honest, it was worse than that. Often my parents made me feel even less secure. To such an extent, I would sleepwalk and have constant nightmares, waking up screaming from dreams that I now recognize as symbolic. Being alone in a speeding car with no steering wheel, being alone on a raft with no way to get to land. My therapist would say I was abused. Not intentionally, but some of what my parents did was certainly not designed to build me up. I wasn't chained to a chair or anything, but I've also heard that sometimes the less insidious and obvious kinds of abuse can be almost more damaging. So, I'm kind of torn. I have to give a disclaimer, but at the same time, I'm aware that anyone can be negatively affected by things that are less overt. A lot of damage can be done in ways that are not so obvious. I didn't know it as a kid, but my parents weren't happy people. To me, they were just my parents. I assumed that's how adults were. My way of thinking, ingrained in me at home as a child, was always, don't show pain. Never let anybody know that they hurt you. And of course, because of what I was subjected to as a result of my facial difference, I hurt a lot. I've come to realize that when we pretend not to be hurt, we suffer. It feels better to say, you hurt me. That allows us to release the pain. It's not a form of weakness, and it doesn't put the person who hurt us in a position of power. It isn't anything more than a statement of fact that we've been hurt. It means nothing more than somebody was cruel or misguided and said something hurtful. Holding in our hurt, on the other hand, allows a kind of pressure to build up, like in a faucet. At some point, the pipe bursts. The key is to keep ourselves open and let it out. Keep everything flowing. At this point in my life, I don't keep things to myself. If somebody says something that hurts me, I tell that person. Nothing else is attached to it. Anything attached to it is either how they choose to see it or how I choose to see it. If someone who is miserable or full of self-doubt or self-worth issues becomes successful and is still unhappy, that's when they have a choice. Either they give up and give in to unhealthy or even deadly coping mechanisms, or they roll up their sleeves and decide, I'm not going to be a victim. I'm going to come through this. When we choose to be victims, life goes on for everybody else. Maybe early on I saw myself as a victim, but then I realized that I gained nothing by seeing myself that way. And even though the world of rock and roll was full of dangers and temptations, it also seemed obvious to me that burning a hole with cocaine through the cartilage of my septum wasn't going to help anything. Back then, I navigated life using a lot of preconceived ideas that formed a structure, which I needed. But over time, I found that some of those ideas were just too difficult. A lot of the rules I was living by were based on nothing. It's okay to be tough on ourselves, but when we make rules for ourselves, they have to be based in experience, and my rules were not realistic. So over a long time, I drew up a new set of rules. The ones in this book. First, I had to unlearn what I'd been taught as a kid. I'd been programmed to shove everything aside, not to accept anything that raised questions about what I was doing. If I didn't talk about something, it didn't exist. When we're children in those formative years, we take our first steps, and not just physically. If our foundation was faulty when we were young, as it was in my case, we had to learn to walk again when we're older. I had to build a new foundation. That was difficult. It was like deprogramming. We are, in essence, programmed by repeated responses or reactions to things. Only when we start to perceive those things differently or add new components to how we react to them can we deprogram ourselves and defuse the emotional bomb. For a long time, I took my childhood and my life experiences as the norm. Kids model what they see at home and think it's normal. And that's how they initially define love, by what they receive at home and how their parents and siblings treat one another. Once I got enough perspective and different experience, I woke up to the fact that my childhood hadn't been the norm. Before a revelation like that, we can't acknowledge the pain. Supplementing with new life experiences and a new perspective, however, takes the charge out of painful things from our past. The memory that we were hurt doesn't go away, but the pain does. And that's an important distinction. I know how much I hurt for years, even decades of my life. I know there was a palpable pain. But the pain is gone, because I rectified and remedied my life. I can acknowledge the hurt, but I no longer feel the pain. The idea of throwing away what I had been taught, discarding the ways I'd been taught to reason and not to reason, to start again from scratch, was daunting. But I needed to do it. I was driven to cleanse because I felt like what I had seen and what I had emulated was poison and would not make me happy. And life wouldn't end well for me. I was unhappy and unsettled, and I certainly felt despair, but this was part of the quest. Would I live with the decay, or would I get a root canal? Would I dig out the rot, or just bear it? First, I had to realize it was okay to question my foundation. After all, my original foundation wasn't making me happy. Second, I realized I could build another foundation, though I also understood this wasn't going to happen overnight. That's why I've always been leery of self-help books and other quick fixes. Going away for a weekend where you don't pee for a couple of days is not going to change your life. You didn't get the way you are in 2 days, and you're not going to undo it over a weekend either. Although I should probably also admit that part of what made the process bearable for me was not realizing how long it would take. Here's the truth. Questioning ourselves is not a weakness. It's a source of strength. There's a great freedom in being able to acknowledge how little we know. There's a cage and handcuffs in thinking we know more than we do. There are shackles in that. Freedom for me came when I admitted I had so much to learn and I knew much less than I'd thought. I'm much happier knowing that many of the things I had thought were, in truth, nonsense. I just made them up. I'd made them up because they made me feel secure. But when we're truly secure, we don't need to think we know everything. That's the other part of it. When we feel secure, we don't need all the rules or ideas about what we know because we're free. We don't need that false sense of support and safety from truisms that aren't true. And that's a release. I had to ask myself, how the hell do you have life all sorted out and all worked out? I had to start to get healthy before I could realize how my past had affected me. When we think our behavior and how we deal with the world is normal, there's nothing to fix. But when we step away from it, we can say, gee, look at all that I'm dealing with and why. It's confining and suffocating to think we know everything. It's freeing to realize we don't. Maybe everything doesn't need a label. We put good and bad, true and untrue on things that don't need those grades or categories. Some things just are. We have to take control of our lives. We don't have to accept who we are today. We can decide to be someone else tomorrow. It's not always easy, but we have to have that extra drive, that extra breath, that extra stride that someone else doesn't to get us where we want to go. Reaching one goal gives us the opportunity to see another goal. And if we reach a goal and think it's all over, then how sad. Goals reveal a roadmap to other goals. The most important thing is to keep moving forward. We don't know where we're going to wind up, and we plot a course that may not lead where we think. But if we're going forward, we'll find our destination. And then, if we're lucky, we'll find another one and another one. Obstacles are what we see when we lose sight of our goals. If we have to jump hurdles, we jump them. It's about shedding and getting rid of all the baggage and the doubt and the voices in our heads from people around us. And if we're relentless and tireless, we ultimately become a person we can love, a person we can embrace. Only then do we become the person we were meant to be. Chapter 3. Every success starts with knowing the difference between a dream and a fantasy. Having big dreams is risky. It's dangerous business. We all had them as children, but for many of us, those dreams died somewhere along the way. In essence, a creative adult is a child who survived. There is a big difference, however, between dreams and fantasy. Dreams are something that we can accomplish, but only when we know ourselves, our actual gifts and real limitations, and have a passionate plan to get from point A to point B. Fantasy, or magical thinking, on the other hand, is an escape from reality. It's enjoyable, and can even be an important part of the creative process that leads to an achievable dream, like writing a song, but it can also distract us from making real progress. If we want to succeed, it's important to dream within the realm of the possible, but that doesn't mean what's possible for someone else, or what someone else has accomplished. It means intrinsically and innately and honestly knowing what's possible for ourselves. Dreaming becomes the blueprint for reality. Not someone else's reality, but our own. Self-delusion is self-defeating. I made a conscious decision decades ago not to fool myself. That doesn't mean I saw things accurately, but I wasn't going to deceive myself. The idea of not being honest with oneself is strange to me. I can't understand why people would bullshit themselves. For better or worse, I want to know who I am, what I do, why I do it, and if it needs to change. My struggle has always been to be the best me. It is ongoing, every day. So I've always been hard on myself, and maybe that's the best way to accomplish what's important. Because it's so easy to please other people. But we go home every night and we're the ones who have to live with ourselves. Compliments and attention are pretty hollow and last only as long as another person is talking to us. The core of true success is within. If we stumble into a type of success where others love what we're doing but we don't, that success is fleeting and hollow. The core of enduring success, as in contentment, comes from loving what we do, because loving what we do will make us love who we are. I will say this, the heart has always been the same. My dream, and the collective dream I shared with Gene, Ace, and Peter back in 1973, started from the premise that we were going to become the biggest rock band around. Of course, that's ridiculous. To many people, including many around us at the time, it didn't seem realistic, but we figured somebody was going to do it. So why not us? Why not me? If we go with the status quo, we tend to live in mediocrity. I was never cut out for that. I always knew that I couldn't work 9 to 5. It was unthinkable. I would have slipped my wrists. Hard work and routine are fine, but that hard work and routine had to be exciting to me. Something I had a passion for. Starting with the notion that Kiss was going to succeed and we were going to become big rock stars was not following anybody's safe path. I didn't want to go on somebody's safe path. And anyway, the traditional paths hadn't opened up. All the kids I knew in my neighborhood in Queens became dentists and lawyers. If I tried to follow that path, I would have ended up homeless. Everything changed when I saw the Beatles. Their performance on the Ed Sullivan Show in February 1964 changed my life. The August 1964 release of their first movie, A Hard Day's Night, also changed the game. I loved the mythology of these four guys who were all for one and one for all. We pictured them all sleeping in the same bed, and the movie offered us a new image of what a band could or should be. The Beatles embodied the idea of four individuals making a band, and you not only loved the band, but also loved each individual. As Kiss came together, that became our goal as well. But as far as dreaming big, I never wanted to be the best band on the block. I never wanted to be the best band in the neighborhood. We were keenly aware of the true playing field. In other words, our goal wasn't to be better than the New York Dolls, who were the hot band in New York City when we were coming up. Our goal was to be as good as our heroes. We refused to judge ourselves on a small scale. Perhaps what helped us succeed was that our vision was far beyond what some of our local competition could conceive. I hate to use the analogy of the box, but in order to succeed outside the box, we have to see the box and not be trapped by it. There's a balance because we don't want to be limited solely by what we know or don't know. It's a fine line. I never fooled myself into believing I could do it the same way the Beatles did it, but I was acutely aware throughout my life that I could touch a nerve. The bands and artists I admired set a standard for me to aspire to. I didn't try to imitate them. The influence I was looking for was inspirational, not literal. Back then, we saw the people who had succeeded, like the Beatles, The Who, or Led Zeppelin. But we didn't necessarily see our competition. We saw the people who were our goal, but not the other contenders. We couldn't see a band in Finland. We couldn't see a band in Dallas, and they couldn't see each other. We saw only the bands we were aspiring to be, but not the other bands that were also aspiring to be them. That had some advantages. It made for individuation. It made for a less homogeneous kind of music scene. Everybody wasn't just borrowing from one another. Nowadays, everybody's aware of everyone else, but that wasn't the case when Kiss started out. Until bands got media attention and national or international exposure, they were left to their own devices, and all anyone was aware of were the local bands or the bands they ended up touring with. When I talk to young bands or young musicians, I sometimes tell them, if the music you're making isn't of the same standard as that of the band you love, then you're not good enough. There's only one measuring stick, and that's not the local competition, but the top ranks. If you're not up there, you need to keep working, and if you don't want to, then you shouldn't be doing it. Any great talent right now is keenly aware of their competition. Thanks to the internet, it's easier to size up the global arena of competition, as opposed to the local competition. And what's happened over the years and decades is that the standard has been upped exponentially because we're now able to view the world's best from any computer on the planet. A band in Austin knows what a band in Oslo is doing, and vice versa. So being the best singer on your block doesn't cut it. I really believe that the talent pool has upped its game. The days of Ted Mack and the original Amateur Hour, which was on TV when I was a kid, or even the first generation of national talent shows like Star Search, seem quaint now. What we saw in those shows was just horrendous compared with the level of The Voice. The truth is, back when Kiss started, we weren't aware of what was going on around us or around the world. We had no way of gauging ourselves against a broad pool of talent when we were coming up. Now people go on the internet and think, geez, I suck. The internet can be terrific because the talent that's uncovered is pretty amazing. Whether or not the people succeed ultimately, or whether the entertainment is all that survives, is another question. But raw ability? If someone is talented and willing to work at it, that person can really raise the bar. The internet also allows people to see who they're up against and be influenced or inspired by that. That's something we simply didn't have when we started Kiss. There's always some mimicry in creative work, and there are now apparently an infinite number of singers out there emulating some of the greats and misguidedly doing vocal runs that border on histrionics. Their vocal stylings often end up more like gymnastics as opposed to being used to communicate emotions. The downside to being able to do all these vocal runs is that it means nothing if there's nothing behind it. Sometimes I hear people singing, and I'll say to my wife, Erin, that person might as well be singing in Mandarin because they have absolutely no clue what they're singing about. So many elements separate the pretenders from the contenders. Sure, Mariah Carey can sing 5 octaves or whatever, while Leonard Cohen could sing only 1/2 octave. But time will tell which of their music lives on. It's not what we're capable of doing. It's what we do with our capabilities. You'll find guys now, unfortunately, who think their favorite blues guitar player is Eddie Van Halen. To do something with depth, with real weight and substance, whether that depth is lost on others, you need roots. You need experience. Someone might say, well, Kiss is superficial, so who's this guy to be talking? Well, not superficial to the 100 million people who've bought our albums so they can listen to them over and over. So when I say that roots are essential to whatever you're going to do, I say it in part because I grew up seeing Otis Redding and listening to Dion and the Belmonts and Irving Berlin and Puccini and Jerry Lee Lewis and Muddy Waters, and the list goes on. The point is, it all adds to the stew. I was a huge Byrds fan. I could play all their songs. I was a fan of Tim Hardin, Phil Oakes, David Blue, the Jim Queskin Jug Band. I went to the Gaslight down in the Village to see Dave Van Ronk. Those artists may seem superfluous to what I do, but they're all in there. I saw the Temptations. I listened to and watched Jackie Wilson, who was a phenomenal singer and an incredibly magnetic performer. I was a huge fan of Eric Anderson. The idea that, stripped away of everything, someone could sit and mesmerize you with a story or a point of view was a revelation. To hear Eric Anderson sing Thirsty Boots was a romantic notion of a different kind of life where somebody incessantly traveled and needed to move. If nothing else, things like that make you aware that there's a whole other world out there. How much of it you want to see is up to you. But I always found that music was a portal into a life that I wasn't part of, but on some level wanted to experience. We can only be as deep as our experiences. We draw from our musical travels, and in my case, even if on the surface some of those places may seem irrelevant, they're all part of it. All the various pieces contribute to a mosaic that represents the richness of our lives and experiences. It's all there, adding to the detail and color. In food circles, people talk about layers of flavors and a flavor profile. Well, you don't get that from one ingredient. You get that from a balance of many. And God knows I'm not original in the sense that I created something new as a vocalist. The proportions and balance of those who inspired me are what created me. In the lore of rock and roll, there are legendary, almost tragic, heroic figures who were said to be can't-miss talents, but who never made it. People like the 1960s British singers Frankie Miller and Terry Reid. Terry was rumored to have been the first choice to front Led Zeppelin, and later to have been offered the vocalist slot with Deep Purple. Instead, nobody's heard of him. Frankie Miller sounds like the blueprint for Rod Stewart. And sometimes I wonder, could I have lived like Frankie Miller or Terry Reid? Could I have maintained the same passion if it hadn't led to commercial success along the way? Well, the truth is, I had no interest in not having commercial success. I suppose everybody wants to be famous. But what are we doing to reach that goal? Don't kid yourself. The bands that have done the best didn't fall into their success, and they certainly didn't sustain it by accident. Nobody who's around for decades stays there by chance. It's work. It's thinking things through. And regardless of what they say, it's a hunger and thirst to stay successful. If you don't have that from the start, you won't achieve success, and you certainly won't sustain it. You have to be clear about what you want and how to get it. Without a plan and a work ethic, you might as well say you want to fly. What separated Robert Plant from Terry Reid? What separated Rod Stewart from Frankie Miller? Probably everything other than their talent. It's how hard they worked. The playing field is not level. I don't think it is in any aspect of life. But opportunities are there for the person who works hardest. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's fun. It's that much tougher for somebody with a facial difference or a physical disability. Even so, it's possible. Is it fair? No. But if we let fair hold us back, then we become victims. And that's not acceptable. No matter how much we cry foul, only we will suffer in the end. We can't win if we don't fight. We can't win if we don't play. So for me, at the worst times, it's always been about fighting to get through it. I've never had a feeling of hopelessness. I've had feelings of despair, but I've never believed that any situation was permanent. We had to take control and acknowledge our pain and then move through it. Hope is based on shaping the future, not on seeing today as permanent. And that is the key to being able to dream big. Of course, the future doesn't happen on its own. We make it happen. And hope is just acknowledging our own role, our own agency. The future is never set in stone. And for that reason alone, there is always hope. I can't imagine giving up. It's so against my nature, because I really believe that we are the masters of our own destiny. Chapter 4. A Fighting Optimism. Sometimes people say to me, "I'm thinking of pursuing music." And I say, "Don't." If you have to think about it, you shouldn't do it. Do it only if you are compelled to do it. I didn't really have a say in what I was going to do. I did it and do it because I have to. If you're considering a career in music, don't bother. You need to have a passion, an insatiable passion that you won't compromise. There's a gap between feeling compelled to do something and making it happen, though. And the bridge is an empowered sense of hopefulness. Ultimately, I have an outlook rooted in optimism, but a fighting optimism, not a passive optimism. An optimism of agency, an optimism that I have the power to make my life what I want it to be, as opposed to just wishing everything turns out okay on its own. The difference between someone who wants to be something and someone who's actually going to accomplish it is also a sense of structure and a sense of steps. A process. It's not enough to want something. We can want it all we want, but if we don't have a sequence or a battle plan, it won't work. Take my friend, Chris Jericho. Chris was told he was too short to be a professional wrestler, but he decided to ignore the rules. He decided he would work harder than anybody else, and he made it. The rules only stand until they're broken, and that is the essence of dreaming big. I'll never have the foundation, background, or technique necessary to be a great chef, but that doesn't mean I shouldn't go forward. The idea that I paint or don't paint based on my knowledge of painting is self-defeating. Whether I cook or not should also not be based on actually knowing what I'm doing. Again, that's self-defeating. After all, who knows anything when they first start? We can't get anywhere without taking that first step. It's been said that the secret to getting ahead is getting started, though that doesn't mean we can't ask questions when we need to. I like stumbling around when I get started on something. Actually, that's kind of how I approached the guitar. I took a few lessons and then went off on my own. Later, I tried another teacher, but I found she didn't want me to go ahead of her lesson plans. So if I was supposed to practice one particular thing before a lesson, but ended up working on additional stuff, that wasn't okay with her. But that kind of approach just isn't in my nature. I like people to be there if I have questions, but don't tell me to slow down. If we acknowledge, identify, and embrace who we are and what we are, then the potential is that much greater. I've painted entire pieces with a palette knife. In a sense, I wanted to tie one hand behind my back, not have the ability to add detail, but rather to give the impression of things and then let the viewer's eye fill in the rest. I did that purposely, to steer myself away from what I don't do well anyway. I'm not going to paint photorealistic pieces. Identify who you are and what you are, and then embrace that rather than fight it in order to be something else. If we define what we're incapable of, then we embrace what's possible. We eliminate the waste of going after what's futile or the things that don't represent who we are. By removing that waste, We embrace our full potential. It goes back to this. If I had decided to become a mathematician or a rocket scientist, I'd be broke. By eliminating the things that were out of the question, I gave myself that much more potential to do what was possible. Of course, there were things I thought at one time were impossible for me, only to find later that my assessment had changed. For example, there was a time when I genuinely thought it would be impossible to be a good father. And yet, I evolved. Part of learning, part of exploration, is changing our horizons. In the beginning, I just wanted to be happy. Simple, right? Well, that turned out to be pretty complex. And when I thought about being a parent, I knew I wanted to be a good parent, but I didn't believe I had the wherewithal. Both of those things came with time and work, and in fact, informed each other. After all, how good a parent can we be if we don't know ourselves and aren't comfortable with who we are? Those sorts of transformations don't happen overnight, but becoming a good parent and a fundamentally happy person have been, perhaps, the most rewarding accomplishments of my life. And they are also the sorts of transformations that led me to other possibilities. Painting, theater, cooking, writing, whatever it is. I pursued becoming a famous musician with everything I had because, for one thing, I knew I was capable of it. When I saw the Beatles, I said to myself, I can do that. Well, based on what? I couldn't play the guitar. I was deaf in one ear, and yet, without intellectualizing it, I innately knew I can do that. The other thing pushing me along was that I was desperate to be happy. But I found out once I had achieved music stardom that I still wasn't happy. And that realization moved me ahead of where I'd been. Accomplishing whatever we set out to do is the stepping stone to another level. It's another rung on the ladder. We never know where we're going to end up. We can only start, and once we start, every step we take, we can see a little more clearly ahead of us. Of course, oftentimes we need a guide. We need somebody to show us options, show us techniques. When it came to singing in The Phantom of the Opera, when I took over the lead in the production in Toronto in 1999, I saw the challenges. I had difficulty figuring out how to remedy certain things vocally. So I met with a few vocal coaches until I finally came across somebody who got it. He understood, and he said to me, "They hired you because of the way you sing. Don't change the way you sing." Which was a relief, because another coach I'd seen had foisted a completely new technique on me. His technique changed my tone dramatically, which was difficult with only 2.5 weeks before I opened in the show. Thankfully, here was somebody who said, "They hired you because they like what you have. Let's just deal with the little issues. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's address what needs to be addressed." Experts in various fields can tell when someone is eager to learn something, and maybe they take that as an appreciation of what they do. It's very inviting when somebody else is interested in what you do and wants to learn. I know it's always appealing to me. I helped a young man get into college a few years back. He wanted to pursue music, and his family asked if I could help. I sat down with him, and he played me a song to impress me. My role, I felt, was to be constructively critical, not to demean him or to discourage him, but to help him. After he got over the shock of my not being bowled over by his music, he said to me later that everybody always told him how great he was. He wanted more. That quality is hard to turn away from when somebody looks to you as a mentor. It's not about my ego. It's more about paying it forward. And another way to live on in another generation. With this young man, I got to help somebody achieve what he wanted. These kinds of situations aren't forgotten, by us or by the person we're helping. They are opportunities for us to share our knowledge with somebody else, to help them achieve their goals, their dreams. Chapter 5. The only rule should be no rules. We have a choice in life. We can choose whether to spend life saying, why? Or to spend it saying, why not? I've gotten the most out of life when I've said, why not? Honestly, we can't know what's behind a door if we don't open it. Unless there are insurmountable, irreparable consequences, we have far more to gain than we have to lose by taking a crack at something. Unlike some people, I'd rather fuck up than not try. Thinking there are finite goals in life narrows our potential to take the ultimate journey, to take the ultimate trip. It limits us in what we're looking for or looking at. We don't get to absorb what's going on around us, which may affect where we ultimately want to go. The work we do to get where we think we want to go should get us where we actually go. Because life is fluid, and the goal we're pursuing shouldn't be finite. In the process, we may decide that where we've gone isn't where we want to be, so we decide to go elsewhere. We can't be too fixed in what we see as necessary accomplishments, because along our way we may find something more important. And if we have tunnel vision, it may blind us to our potential. Something that may appear to be a diversion could actually be the more rewarding path. It's a problem when we set goals for ourselves that constrict us from changing course. The goal of KISS in 1973 was find a manager. But if we had stuck to the well-trodden path, we'd never have found Bill LeCoin. And without Bill, who knows how things would have gone? Maybe a different manager would have tried to push us toward conventional decisions, and we never would have become the KISS that is recognized and loved 45 years later. When it came to realizing our dream as KISS, we broke every rule in the book. Most of what we've done is contrary to what would seem logical. When people say, why did you choose Peter or Ace? Or why did you choose to work with Gene? The answer is surprisingly simple. Because it felt right. Honestly, nothing about the four of us would have necessarily put us all in the same band. If we had tried to put together a band of like-minded people, we would have ended up with different people in the band. There's no way we would have come together. Once we joined forces and started to write songs and play out, it didn't seem strange to us to go with Bill LeCoin, who had no experience in management, as our manager. It was no more strange than wearing white makeup and making our own t-shirts. We knew exactly what we were doing. Going with the status quo or listening to people say, be like us, is something I've never had any interest in. Whether it was putting on the makeup, taking off the makeup, having a manager who had never managed, signing with a record company that had no real experience with a rock band, the list goes on. Just doing things the way that felt right, as opposed to the way that everybody else did them, seemed totally natural. I'm glad that following the rules works for some people, but it doesn't work for me. Never has. And that's one of the keys to my success. Why not? Even though our manager had never managed anybody, he clearly understood the band. We were a band with white makeup and 8-inch heels. We weren't what was currently popular at that time. We weren't John Denver. There had never been a band like ours, so why shouldn't we try a manager who wasn't like existing managers? The normal way of doing things can give normal results. Extraordinary ways of doing things can give extraordinary results. Of course, when you operate that way, you'll also make mistakes and face setbacks. But learning from mistakes fuels success. If you don't give up, a mistake is just another step toward success. If something doesn't work out, whether it's in the kitchen, in our professional lives, or in a relationship, it doesn't mean failure. It's just more fuel for success. After all, we can either repeat our mistakes or use them to plot a change in course. I don't regret any of the departures KISS made as a band. They were essential. They had consequences, but it was never going to be the end of the story. I needed to do those things, and to deny them ultimately would have denied the band and myself. I needed to write, "I was made for loving you," for instance. I needed to. The premise of Kiss when we got together was no rules and no boundaries, and that's what people embraced about us. So it would be contrary to suddenly say, "I'm going to live within another set of boundaries that the fans set." At the dawn of the 1980s, we started to experiment musically. I was willing to accept the consequences of what I did, but I also felt the fans had to understand that our premise of no rules and no boundaries was part of what they had accepted in the first place. As fans, they championed us because we did things our way. Thankfully, most of the time,